Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the proper balance between the operas that have reliably pleased audiences for generations and those that are new, modern, and exciting, but lie outside the canon of classic works? As general director of the Fort Worth Opera, Darren K. Woods has drawn national attention to the company he manages. Last summer, his commitment to both innovative programming and financial responsibility got him named to Opera News Magazine's list of the top 25 influences in the next wave of opera's evolution. Now the Fort Worth Opera has announced the lineup for its festival seasons of 2014 through 2016, the start of a 10-year vision to premiere and promote important works by contemporary composers from North and South America. Darren Woods is here to talk about it now. Darren, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's great to be here.
So the big announcement officially came this morning. This 10-year vision gets underway next season. And just in the first phase, there are three world premieres?
That's correct. And it's sort of what we've been doing, but we'd never articulated our vision to the public at large to say this is what we're dedicated to, is to bringing alongside the classical, beautiful, traditional pieces, these contemporary pieces. So we have a world premiere next year with Blood with Ink that deals with a Mexican nun, Sor Juana Inés de la Cruz. It's very well known in the Hispanic community. Her story is, and it's beautiful, lush music. It seems almost not contemporary. Then we have something very electronic with Libby Larson's A Wrinkle in Time in 2015. And then in 2016, we were lucky enough to get the first large-scale opera by David T. Little and Royce Vavrick. And they will be writing. We're just beginning the story process of writing about JFK's last morning, not the assassination, but his last morning in Fort Worth and all the political intrigue that was going on at the time before he left Fort Worth to come to Dallas that day.
That's right. People forget that he woke up that morning in a Fort Worth hotel, right?
Yes, absolutely. The Texas Hotel, which is, I think, now the Hilton, but it was the Texas Hotel then. There's a lot of local color. You know, what I really wanted to find for the 70th anniversary was a local story that would have national resonance. I didn't want to have it be done once in Fort Worth and that be it. I wanted something that the nation could focus on. And there's so many little wonderful, intriguing things. Ruth Carter Stevenson, who just sadly passed away last night, went through to all her friends and to all the museums and collected many pieces of priceless art and put it in the president's suite. Mm-hmm. And we were lucky enough to talk to her before she passed away, and she told us about where she collected and what she did, and that she told the Secret Service to get out of her way. She was going to decorate the president's room. So we're really trying to find that local voice. We talked to the cameraman that day. We talked to so many people, sitting with Jim Wright for a couple of hours, just letting him talk about history is pretty great. So the story is just formulating itself, but that will be our 70th anniversary and the 10th anniversary of the festival.
So it seems like, Darren, with any great story, there's a decision to be made about the best vehicle for telling it. It could be a documentary, it could be an article, it could be a novel, it could be a book, it could be a film. Are there certain stories that are particularly suited to what opera does best?
Yeah, that's a great question, because when you look at some of the novels that are out there, that you say, well, does that need to be sung? Has that story been told in its best way? And I thought Dead Man Walking is a perfect example of a great book, a great movie, and an even better opera, which really just brought it even more to your soul. I like pieces or subjects that cause a conversation. And that's what we talk about redefining the opera experience. I don't want a passive audience, whether it's Bohème or whether it's A Wrinkle in Time. I want things that spark conversation that, you know, months down the line, people are still talking about that subject. Someone said, to the point of Dead Man Walking, someone came up to me not 3 months ago and said, you know, that production still haunts me to this day. Hmm. And that was in 2009, and people are still talking about that. Having a conversation about war with Glory Denied, looking at, you know, Allen Ginsberg's poetry with Hydrogen Jukebox and the things that we've been able to make the community communicate. Those are the subjects that I really like. Some things I probably wouldn't personally commission that have made, you know, great operas. You know, Moby Dick is a perfect example of a great opera, and I might not have done that. Actually, incidentally, I initially passed on Silent Night. You know, I was one of the ones that I said, I'm not sure that's for us. And Mark Campbell's libretto, and when I saw all of it, Mark Campbell, Kevin puts this piece together, I went, oh my gosh, now we've got to bring this to Fort Worth because it's perfect. So it's just sort of what appeals to us as an artistic team and what we think our community would like to hear and see.
Tell us more about that story, Silent Night.
It is the movie is Joyeux Noël. It is the historic, I think, telling of when the French, German, and British, Scottish troops lay down their arms on Christmas Eve and shared food and stories, and they actually had a Christmas Eve service together before they returned to war. What I think is really interesting about Silent Night and what Mark does so beautifully is, A, all the troops speak in their language. So it's in French, it's in German, it's in English, and the mass is in Latin. So he really constructs an incredible piece. And you would think that the Silent Night, the Christmas Eve service would be at the end of the opera. It's not. It's at the end of Act One. And so what you see in Act Two is how hard it is to return to killing people when you've broken bread with them and when you'd shared with them. So they have another day of armistice where they allow each other to bury their dead. And you see these he has several different relationships in each country troop that you follow these beautiful relationships, these people, and you realize these are people that are following orders and the consequences of what they did when they didn't follow orders on that Christmas Eve night. It's told in the most lush, orchestral, beautiful, I don't want to say tonal, but almost tonal setting. It's not a scary piece, whereas some of them are more electronic and some of them are more rock and roll. This is a real, almost contemporary traditional opera, I would say.
I'm curious if having a 10-year plan, which seems wise but is rare these days because the economy is strange and the world changes quickly, if part of that is also 10 years to help our audience completely evolve to where they are comfortable sort of buying a season ticket and knowing that everything this season will be worth seeing.
I think that's a really a great point. What is opera companies have traditionally done is just announce next season. But, you know, if we start talking about JFK now, we start talking about Dog Days now, and we give 2 or 3 years of conversation before people actually come, it's a much better than 9 months or 10 months to sort of wrap your arms around the story, especially, you know, right now JFK, because we want the Fort Worth community involved in it, or the Metroplex community involved in it. But it just seemed to make more sense to sort of have out a longer plan. The reason we didn't flesh out 10 years is because I'm really looking now with Frontiers, we got submissions from South America. We got submissions from Mexico, from Canada. And I really want to – there's some really terrific Hispanic composers out there that haven't been heard. And so in that next wave, you look for people look for some Hispanic and some Spanish music. Look for some Canadian music, more music from North America and South America and everything in between. I just think it's what my thing with singers has always been is try to find that young, fresh singer that is just getting started before they hit the big time. Now we've really shifted into not only doing that, but finding those composers like David T. Little. Kevin Putz was at Fort Worth Symphony as a resident composer for a while. So finding those guys that are just beginning to do it, they're going to be the voice of our generation, and indeed probably for the next 30, 40, 50 years. We want to put their music into the regular operatic canon right away.
Is the explicit focus on North and South American composers an acknowledgement of the fact that still, for whatever reason, we take the European composers more seriously?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that's changing a great deal. I think with people like Carlo Floyd, with Mark Adamo, Jake Heggie, Ricky and Gordon, I'm going to forget some of my best friends, they have really, with Little Women, Dead Man Walking, Grapes of Wrath, Moby Dick, we've developed an American voice that's not scary anymore. I think for a long time, American composers were so trying to imitate European composers, mm-hmm. especially German composers, you know, atonality and dodecaphony and all those crazy things that they did, but really embrace the fact that we Americans like melody and embracing some more of musical theater idioms in that. And so I think finding those voices, I think the new thing with David and some of the new composers is embracing our love of electronic music and rock and roll idiom and things that we haven't necessarily seen in opera. And I'll tell you, I know we'll talk specifically about Dog Days, but when I was sitting in that show, I really felt as though I was hearing a shift in music, the way you heard Beethoven taking us out of classical music and into romantic. I really felt like I was present when something really historical and monumental was taking place.
What was it that felt so different?
The fact that he courageously uses real classical music, real classical writing. He does a 9-minute extended aria for the young girl, but it's infused with electronics. But it doesn't feel like just putting a blender and shaking up and throwing out there. It's really beautiful compositions using all the skills that he has amassed as a real classical composer and as a rock and roll drummer. Mm-hmm. His music also has an inner pulsation to it, an inner rhythm that is inescapable. And before I ever saw Dog Days, when I was considering who we were going to commission for JFK, I listened to Soldier Song. I listened to his comic opera, Finkensport, which is kind of best in show for finches. It's really kind of very funny. That sort of pulsing rhythmic feeling of his music. And I didn't know anything about him except just listening to his music. And then I found out he was a drummer. But it seemed so perfect for that, what we thought of Camelot and that inner pulsation of JFK's administration and from the Bay of Pigs, just from what we know about his life and everything now and all the internal struggle, that sort of rhythmic feeling was something that really spoke to me. Then when I saw Dog Days and saw what a master he was, then I was really thrilled that we got the commission before we did that.
And Dog Days is sort of a post-apocalyptic story?
Yeah, it's a post-apocalyptic story, and it focuses on one family, a father and a mother, two brothers, and it's told through the eyes of Lisa, the 12, 13-year-old girl who's played by a very small adult who is astonishing. And there is another character where a man who has given up humanity dresses as a dog. Mm-hmm. He does not speak the entire time. He merely is a dog. And you watch this family facing starvation and freezing to death, trying desperately to hold on to whatever humanity is left. There's one in the beginning, they sing Grace together. And the father says, I just want to sit around the table and feel normal. And then in Act Two, when clearly the rations are gone, the water's gone, they sit around the table and they sing Grace again. But this time David writes the same Grace in a much more disjointed musical language, that you hear the suffering, you hear the freezing cold in their voices, and yet they're still sitting around plates of grass that they've gotten out of the yard and giving thanks because it's trying to make themselves feel normal. It was one of the most spectacular evenings in the theater I've ever spent, and I tell everybody at the end of it, everyone sat in the theater because it really felt profane to clap. You had to live with it. And then one by one, people started applauding, and then we all sort of went crazy. But it was the most visceral experience I've ever had, and yet beautiful. And there's an aria that little Lisa sings where she's clearly starving, and she's looking in the mirror, and this brilliant projection of her face in the mirror. There's a camera in the mirror, and so you see her face. And she talks about how she now looks like the models in the magazines that she used to look at. She talks about her collarbone necklace and the stones of the sand and the beach on her cheeks. And she's clearly trying to come to terms with the fact that she's starving to death. And yet the aria is so gloriously beautiful.
Do you think that the sort of seamless coalescence that you describe between classical music and more electronic music is an outgrowth of the fact that young American composers are not necessarily taught how to make operas?
I don't know. I haven't really thought about it that way. I mean, David has written largely for the voice. He's written for his ensemble Newspeak and written a lot of instrumental stuff. But even his big symphonic work was a vocal symphony that he just wrote for the Brooklyn Philharmonic. I think that opera is a mountain that every composer wants to climb. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you just the volume of manuscripts and scores and ideas and treatments that I personally get every week is enormous. So there's a lot of people out there trying to do it.
Darren K. Woods is with us. He is general director of the Fort Worth Opera. We're talking about redefining the opera experience. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
populate our job to mate. Prepare yourself, Patty boy. Go forth and repopulate. We'll be kings of the new world. Kings of the new world.
A little bit there from Dog Days, which we were discussing before the break with Darren K. Woods, who is General Director of the Fort Worth Opera. If you'd like to join our conversation or ask a question, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Darren, I want to talk about this line that is, I take it somewhat controversial, between Americans' great embrace of musical theater and opera. You know, people are flocking to see Les Mis who might think, well, I'm not going to buy a ticket to the opera. Where is the line? Does it need to move? Are you sometimes uncomfortable with it? What? Talk about that.
A little bit. You know, I wish Hollywood had done a better job of casting people who sing well. You know, I think Les Mis is a terrific movie. I enjoyed it, but I, being a singer myself and hiring singers for a living, I was disappointed in the singing. So I think maybe sometimes in the end it does more harm than good. But I think it's interesting that people have flocked to see Les Mis and are still reticent about coming into the opera house. I think what those of us, certainly Fort Worth Opera, is doing is really trying to embrace that theatrical experience and break away from the fact that it is not a passive experience. You're not going to go in there and sit and listen to 3 hours of Italian opera and not understand what's going on. Even if you're listening to La Boheme and there's the surtitles over the stage, you can read it in English. We want to make that piece as theatrical as possible so that it is more cinematic. I think what we're also seeing in not only new work but in producing of older work is you're seeing scenery with film in it. You're seeing video sneak in. You're seeing there's a new thing called scribe technology, which is almost like gigantic iPads that you can program to do things. We had a light wall in our Mikado production. So all of us are trying to think about how to make our productions more cinematic so that when people do come, they can have a little bit more to relate to than that sort of, I'm going to have to wear a long dress and sit there and have a glass of champagne and listen to an opera in a language that I don't understand, and there's not going to be relevance for me. And I think that there is a lot of relevance in Boheme and all the things, the traditional stuff that we do as well. But I think finding subjects that really speak to people today is important.
Are people, are audience members who are not especially familiar with opera, are they surprised to find a much more naturalistic style of acting from the performers on stage who are singing these roles?
They are. And I think that that's the biggest surprise and biggest takeaway from, certainly from people my age or older that go, I think kids now, they come and they're like, they're ready for anything. But we've, you know, with opera being televised and with HD broadcasts from the Met, singers are in shape now, and they look great. I mean, we have a good gym that gives them, you know, gym memberships, and those singers are there every day because they have to look great. The visual is just as important. The theatrical is just as important. And I think the fact that they're not, you know, doing all that melodramatic acting is one of the biggest surprises to audience members that come, that it is like seeing a really great play intimately, even if it's in Bass Hall, which is a big theater. But we also are doing a lot of stuff in a smaller place. So if you really want that in-your-face experience, this year it's Glory Denied, next year it's With Blood With Ink, and the next year it's Dog Days. You can be up close, personal, and right there with the actors. In that case, the acting has to be incredibly subtle, and the makeup and wigs have to be incredibly subtle because we're in the same room with those people.
And is the idea sometimes of these smaller productions that you can take some more risks than you could with something that's going to ultimately cost $1 million to get onto the stage?
It's surprising that we always think that way, but we find that when we do these chamber works, they end up costing a lot of money too, because especially the new ones, because the productions don't exist. So you're building, you know, we're building from scratch. So we've got a designer, well, Austin Scarlett's designing our costumes for With Blood With Ink, and we've got Erhard Rahm designing a set. So you create it all from scratch. What we do is we find that we can do more, I don't want to say controversial, because that's because With Blood With Ink is certainly not controversial. We can do much more timely subjects, I think. You know, and people could argue that, well, what is timely about a nun from the 16th century? Well, she was fighting for women's rights to be educated, and we have a little girl that was just shot in the head who was fighting for women's rights to be educated in her country. And so that is a very timely story told in a very intimate setting. Again, when we did Hydrogen Jukebox, people came out. It was Vietnam, you know, the sexual revolution, drugs. People came out of there and said, that was life-changing. That was life. And as a producer, a general director, you live for those moments where someone says, thank you for having the courage to do that, or thank you for bringing that to us. We say from the beginning, it's not for everybody. It's not for you. Then you'll be upset if you come. Don't come. But I think it's important. We describe ourselves as, you know, we have all these great museums in Fort Worth that do different things. We have the, you know, Western with the Amon Carter, and we've got Modern, and we've got the Kimball. We've got Science and History. I'm the only opera company in Fort Worth, and it is my job to see that all those constituents are taken care of as far as what they want.
You're the Kimball and the Amon Carter and the Science Museum
and,
all wrapped
and
up in
Modern
one.
All wrapped into one. And we take that responsibility very – so we'll always do the standard pieces. But, you know, the ones that speak to me obviously are the ones that people walk out of there and they go to a bar and that's all they talk about until they go to bed that night. And when they wake up in the morning and have coffee, they're talking about it again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jack on the phone in Grand Prairie. Hi, Jack.
Oh, yeah. Hi, thanks. I just wanted to say on the YouTube, I ran into Rossini's Turk and Italy animation. And there's this whole series of animation with, and it would be Mozart, all these classical musicians, but done in the kind of stop-start animation. And it was just a terrific way, I thought, for sure, to let children, you know, in on this, because it's just magical.
What a great idea. Yeah, I think so, too. In any way we can do that. Fort Worth Opera has a real big in-school education program, but that's part of what Having a Wrinkle in Time is it's a children's book. You know, 12. I read it first when I was 12. I read it again a couple of years ago. I've read it 40 times in my life. But we wanted to create a piece that spoke to every generation, and that you, as a father, and your wife and your children could come in the theater, be comfortable, and see this wonderful transformative opera. You know, I was from Luling, Texas. I never saw an opera till I was in one. That's the truth. But you know, Bugs Bunny and the Barber of Seville, and spoofing. Elmer Fudd spoofing the Wagner's Ring. That's the only connection I had to opera. I sang, I played trombone, I played piano. I was going to be a band director. That didn't work out very well.
You've done all right.
I've done all right. So I think to your point, absolutely. And YouTube is a great gift to us now that we can find those things. And I don't know that Turco and Italia, Jack, so I'm going to go look that up and see it right after we're done.
We have an email here from a listener who asks, does this mean that the traditional operas will be eliminated, or is this new focus in addition to the oldies? I want to make sure you can clarify that.
It's absolutely in addition to. We had a whole artistic committee at Fort Worth Opera that's been working on this for a year. And we really like the division of two from the standard repertory and two from the new repertory living side by side. So this year we have La Boheme and we have Daughter of the Regiment living side by side, Ariadne, which is arguably not that – it is 20th century, but standard repertoire, and Glory Denied. So we're probably going to look at a 50-50 division most of the time. The chamber piece, the Opera Unbound series, will most always be of a contemporary nature. The main stage contemporary piece will probably be not only world premieres, but things like Silent Night that we bring from other opera companies. One thing we noticed over the last 10 years is – something gets done like Silent Night, and we've all planned 5 years in advance. So the next chance you get to see it is 5 years down the pike. Things aren't going to get into the canon fast enough if you do that. When Puccini did Butterfly, he had 7 theaters lined up, or 8 theaters. Verdi always had several theaters, so they could tinker with the piece before it went to the next theater. So we're trying to, all of us, I think, we've gotten over the, we've got to have the world premiere. You know, all of us have gotten over that. Now, when a great piece like Silent Night or Dead Man Walking or any of these come, we want to move them into our repertory as fast as possible.
There is a lot of buzz about this character tenor who's been cast in Daughter of the Regiment playing the butler. And I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about him. And
I'm returning to the stage after 18 years, I think it's something like that. It's the role of Hortensius. It's the butler to the Marquise of Birkenfield. And I don't sing much, so you're safe, everybody. But I do have a lot of dialogue. And this came about. It was a role that I did, and my friend Joyce Castle, who's coming to do the Marquis, did a lot, and she's still doing it. We never, in all of our years of singing together, got to do these roles together. And I thought, well, I could probably come out of retirement just this once and do, because I want to do it with Joyce. And again, I don't have to sing a lot, and I think it'll be fun. I don't know.
How can you speak to how the experience is different for the performers when they are working on a piece that they maybe have heard 1,000 times, maybe have performed in multiple times, as compared with a brand new work or something that is not established or even a world premiere? Is it entirely different, or is it basically the same process of finding the character and finding how they're going to interpret this character?
It's the same, and it's completely different. Mm-hmm. You know, the way you research your character is always the same. It's always great to create a new piece, and I was really lucky to sing a lot of new pieces at Santa Fe and in Houston. And it's always great to create a piece because the composer's writing for your voice, and you're discovering it together. And you can go to him because he's still alive and go, you know, that B flat's a little bit tough. Can we make that, you know, maybe a little lower? Mm-hmm. But just finding a whole new way, a new story to tell that no one's ever seen before. You know, I did over 350 performances of Butterfly and 350 performances of The Marriage of Figaro. But when you're a performer and that's your livelihood and your job, I always tried to find something fresh in it or something I didn't know. I'll never make that mistake. I directed Marriage of Figaro 3 years ago. And even after doing that 350 times, finding how much about those people I learned just through peeling back more layers of the onion was incredible. And so all those characters are incredibly complex. And so doing Basilio in The Marriage of Figaro, I think today would be just as rewarding as creating a new role in Libby Larson's A Wrinkle in Time. It's just really fun to know that when you're the first one who's done it, and 200 years from now when they pull that score off the thing, your name is in there for having done it for the first time, and you're creating something. And we as singers spend a lot of time interpreting other people's work. And indeed, when you do a new work, you're interpreting that composer's idea, but you're getting to create that vocal moment for the very first time, and there's something that's nothing like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. My dad was in the Dallas Opera Orchestra for 23 years, so I saw just about every performance during that period for free, so it was great. But what I started to notice was that there was a certain amount of street credibility among the opera companies. What they seemed to be doing is they would, like, do normal standards, and then they would pick some obscure Janáček opera or some new work. Talk a little about the pressures to maintain a certain credibility by premiering new works, by going and finding new composers and commissioning new works and all of that stuff. Because what I noticed was they had no problem spending $8 million on The Voyage of Edgar Allan Poe, but they would spend 5 cents on The Marriage of Figaro. That's what I started to notice, was that credibility was really important. So talk a little about that pressure. Thank you.
Does it feel like pressure to you?
I love pressure. it is really difficult because, again, you're creating the new pieces from scratch. JFK does not exist. And we do spend a lot of time renting other people's production. We make a conscious effort at Fort Worth Opera to – we're doing Bohème again, which we did 7 years ago or 8 years ago, I think. We're doing a completely different production because we don't want you to see the same production that you saw in the past. Other companies do it differently. It is the – you have to budget – for not selling as many tickets to the Janáček piece or to the new piece. Happily, we've changed that a little bit. We have a lot of more people coming to – as many people coming to the new pieces as to the standard rep pieces. But to your point, it is when you have to spend, as you say, an inordinate amount of money to commission and build a new set, costumes, everything for JFK, you do probably turn to a really great rental house to rent a Bohème or Daughter of the Regiment. We've taken up with opera companies closing, we've bought some of the scenery around the country, so we own it. We're refurbishing it, so it looks new and is new. And what I try to do with those casts in particular is I try to get a really hot singer that we've been trying to get for a long time. We have Sean Panikkar, Mary Dunleavy in Bohème, Ava Pine, who's a favorite of the entire North Texas, is coming back for Daughter. So we take those pieces. We feel as much pressure to do a great Bohème as I feel to do a great Glory Denied.
Talk about the process by which you are introduced to composers and sort of matched up with people who might want to have a work commissioned by the Fort Worth Opera, and what the get to know you and the interview process is. Is that accurate to describe it that way?
Well, once you start doing with your very first commission, which ours was Frau Margot by Tom Pastieri in 2007. The works start flooding into your office. They come unbidden.
These guys are buying new work.
Yes. I had today, just with the press release that went out, I was contacted by five composers this morning before I came on the program. Five. With ideas, pitches. So they come to you. The Opera America, our service organization, has done 2 years of New Works Forum that was funded by the Andrew Mellon Foundation. So composers, librettists, producers, publishers, all of us come together for 3 days and just talk about new work. And that's where you sort of start doing the dance. Again, through Beth Morrison Productions, I had met David T. Little and I had met Royce. And I really liked them as people. I knew that one day then I got to know their work. Then they heard about JFK. And Royce and I had dinner and he said, we need to have dinner again and have it be a business dinner because we want to lobby to do this piece. And at that point, I was thinking, well, maybe I should get, you know, one of the realest, big established composers like Jake or Mark. But we really came to a real good meeting of the minds on the piece and what we wanted to say and how it was going to be musically, even when we didn't know what exactly the piece was going to be. So you do have to it's a long process. It's 3 years of your life with these people, and you really have to know that you're speaking the same language, that there's a level of trust that have to be built, because I'm going to be taking what David gives me. I'm with them going to be hiring singers, designers, directors. Kurt Howard, our producing director. There's a whole bunch of people. Joe Willick, our conductor. Many people go into making this stew. And it really is David and Royce's baby. I asked Jake Heggie a long time ago when I did my very first commission. I said, I was so nervous. I said, what do I do for my composer? And he said, just be there. Just be there and be a good resource for him to feel comfortable, trust you, and know that his piece or her piece is going to be in the most loving hands that it could possibly be.
We're speaking this hour with Darren K. Woods, who is General Director of the Fort Worth Opera. We're talking about how the Fort Worth Opera is looking to redefine the opera experience. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can email think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
That was Sleep from Silent Night, the opera that we discussed earlier with my guest, Darren K. Woods, who's general director of the Fort Worth Opera. I have to tell you, Darren, we were going to take this down much sooner than we did, but it's just so beautiful.
It is beautiful. And that's the point. That's modern music. David T. Little and Kevin Putz are of the same generation. And unlike classical music and romantic music and where you really sort of you can say that and you get a sound in your ear. There are so many voices right now out there that is contemporary music, and Dog Days is contemporary music, and they live side by side in the same world. And they're both – I mean, that's beautiful. That you just heard three different languages, French, German, and English being sung simultaneously. This happens early in the piece. It's after the first big battle, and the men are – the snow starts, and it's starting to cover the dead bodies out there, and they're going to their bunkers saying – sleep, we'll be safe for 3 hours. Think of your wife. Think of your children at the door waiting for you to come home. Find a way to you know, just rest these 3 hours. And again, Mark Campbell's brilliant libretto in putting all that together is so beautifully transcendent to me.
Okay, I want to go back. We were talking about commissioning new works before the break, and I have to ask this question. And if you don't want to talk specifically about JFK, you don't have to. But you talk about investing 3 years, and it's not just your time, but it's the composer's time. It's the entire company. It's the reputation of the company. It's this big world premiere. What if it's not good? If we don't want to talk about JFK, let's talk about in general. What if this thing that you've devoted so many resources and so much energy to doesn't work? There are novels by great novelists that don't work.
Yeah, and as we talked about during the break, you know, Verdi didn't hit 100% all the time either. Sometimes they don't. You try to do everything you can. What used to not be done and is done more and more now are workshops. Mm-hmm. That you know, I have a summer company, Siegel Music Colony, that has its own theater and pianists and rehearsal spaces and young singers, and JFK and A Wrinkle in Time will have 2 or 3 workshops before it even comes to stage. So we will have dramaturgs, we'll have test audiences look at it. We will look at it from all sorts of different ways. There are now companies in New York like Beth Morrison Productions, American Lyric Theater, American Opera Projects that specifically workshop these pieces. And so we're starting to partner with them in finding a piece through Frontiers or doing something like JFK with Royce and David. There'll be a libretto reading at the American Lyric Theater in about a year, so we can listen to the story before as David's writing it. So that's the time to go, well, you know, does that feel tight enough? Do we need to expand this a little bit? Then when the music's set to it, does that aria tell it like we want it to tell it? And so you do have a lot of – you bring people in at different points too. So right now it's just the composer, the librettist, myself, Larry Adelson, and Kurt Howard, and our conductor. Then soon we'll bring in a director after the libretto's written, because we don't want the director to impose that on the librettist.
Yeah, yeah.
And as one by one people are brought in and look at it with outside eyes, you shape the piece. You know, we've had a really good batting average so far, so I have high hopes. But there have been friends of mine who did. You get their opening night, and it's just not working. Most of the time, though, when that happens, it's you haven't put enough resources behind the process to get it to the stage.
Is there also a risk of over-workshopping so that you have too many cooks spoiling the broth or too many people suggesting changes?
Yeah. You have to be really – and it has to – again, it's starting with the trust building. You know, right now we're doing a dance of 4 people or 5 people, and we see each other every time we go to New York. We're bringing – Royce and David will be here for 2 weeks in residence just to live here, look at our hall. We're all just getting to become friends and colleagues. But yes, and there's also a danger of getting too close to the piece, mm-hmm, and not being brave enough to go, I think there's a flaw there, or this is troubling to me. We had to pull the plug on a piece that we were fully committed to, but it just never came to fruition ultimately. And we were brave enough to go, you know what? We've walked down that. It's just not going to get to the finish line.
Yeah.
And that was very painful because we'd spent a year and a half with the piece.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Lori in Fort Worth. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I went to all of the operas in the last season that they had, from Lysistrata to Three Decembers, but I actually enjoyed their informal presentation that they did of opera shots at the Live Oak, where everybody was wearing blue jeans and the singers had blue jeans, and it just made opera so real. It wasn't complicated or unreachable anymore, just real and exciting.
Thanks so much, Laurie. That's a program that I have to say was not my idea. It was my junior staff that came up with taking opera to a bar. And what was fun about the one that we went to that Laurie did was we introduced a brand new opera by Patrick Soleri called Figaro's Last Hangover, which was a 10-minute comic opera set in a bar. And the whole premise was an asteroid's coming to destroy the Earth, and Figaro's got 10 minutes, and he sees his old girlfriend, he makes up with her, breaks up with her, and the asteroid hits all in 10 minutes. So he decides he'll have a beer. We brought Patrick down. She's right. It was packed with people. We had kind of like opera karaoke. Our pianist was there. Anyone who wanted to get up and sing opera, our chorus was there. Arias, fun music theater songs. But then we had a little set, and we did a South premiere of Figaro's Last Hangover. And so I'm glad you enjoyed it, Laurie. I love those. We have a couple more coming up, so we'll let you all know.
Are there things that you don't have to do, but you feel like are good? I mean, I know that, you're very committed, and Fort Worth Opera is very committed to education. And I wonder if that is, if there's a little element of that that thinks, well, this is our audience in 15 years, or if it really is sort of because that sort of education is lacking in the school.
It's a little bit of both. And probably because I'm more passionate about in-school performances and taking opera to people rather than say, please come into the great temple of opera, because I was raised in a little town in Texas, in Luling, Texas, and had a traveling troupe of musicians come and sang to me. It would have been like water in the desert. You know, I mean, all I knew that I could be when I grew up as a musician was a band director. That was my whole point of reference. And I was in the Allstate Choir and the Allstate Band. I did all that. But a life as a performer or an administrator in opera, I didn't know that word. And so that word is so not a problem for younger people. I had a person from New York that came down last year to the festival, and she said, Where do these young people come from? Are all your audiences like this? This is amazing that people are in jeans and they're treating this just like it's an evening at the theater or the cinema, but they're completely engaged, completely enwrapped, and they're here for a 21st century opera. And I said, you know, we've worked 12 long years to get it to that. But yeah, I think the in-school stuff, Opera Shots is certainly doing it. You know, we got good television coverage last time. People talked about it. Finding that way in front of the people, in front of your computer, onto your iPad, it's the way people that are really making things happen, I think, are getting to. We've got to get to people where they are before they come to see us.
Do you have a flash mob planned?
You know what? I'd love to do that, but it's so much work.
It's funny that you stage these gigantic productions and a flash mob is too much.
I know. We've thought about it. And so Opera Shots was our thing that we made up that sort of takes the place of our flash mob. So join us in a bar somewhere soon.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Terry in Dallas. Hi, Terry.
Yes. Hello there. I appreciate your program. I'm an old opera lover, and I mean old. And I see the differences over the years between opera styles and the voices that come on. I'm used to the Tetrazzinis, the Gallicurchis, the Caruso's, and the Björn, Jussi Björlings, those people. Why? Because they were so melodious and called the bel canto style. And when it goes beyond that, I lose it. And that's unfortunate because I know some of the operas that I've seen have been fabulous, even though they're very modern music. But it takes a lot of getting used to, and it's a generational thing. My kids don't care for the old styles. They like the new stuff.
What about that, Darren?
Thanks so much. I love all those singers that you mentioned, too, and I've listened to them on recording and YouTube and everything else. But I would argue that there are great singers here, too. Just the other day, yesterday, and they met HD broadcast, brand new tenor, Brian Emil, who's already sung at the Dallas Opera, he did the Lucia here, became a superstar overnight. Covent Garden, and there he was. He made his Met debut on less than 48 hours. They flew him over from England, he's an American boy, to sing arguably one of the hardest tenor roles in the world, and the ovation was incredible. And I would argue that he is every bit as spectacular as Caruso was in his day. We have Stephen Costello that we've had here. We have Michael Fabiano that both companies have had here. We've got those great – Eileen Perez. Those great singers are out there. There's just many more opera companies, and there's jet travel has made people be able to sing a lot more than they used to back in Björling's day, when you had to take a boat from Europe and spend a month at high sea before you sang at the Met. You had a little bit more resting time. So maybe we have more burnout now from singers because they're able to sing so much and so often. But the really great ones know, like Susan Graham, she's been doing it for 25 years now, and that voice is just as fresh and as spectacular as it ever was. You can hear she'll be at Dallas Opera this year. You can hear her yourself.
Tell us more about the casting process, because hearing you talk, it's evident that obviously everyone needs to be in perfect voice, but that's not it. That's not the only thing that causes you to choose someone.
It's the first thing. You know, you've got to have a great voice. I always say in an audition, someone says, how do you listen to like 60 singers a day for 10 days? And I say, you know, whether it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon and you've heard a day of bad singing, when that one walks in and that voice just strikes you, I know in five notes whether or not I like the voice.
The qualities of the voice.
Quality, the sound. Then I start looking for their connection to the text. Are they really communicating the text? Are they moving me in any way? Is it somebody that I really think that my audience should see? I think from casting not only singers but directors, everybody, we really take it a great responsibility that we want our audience to have a transformative experience. And so the casting has to be perfect. You know, sometimes like all of us, we get it wrong. But for instance, when we did Angels in America, it wasn't only the singing and it wasn't only the acting. I actually talked to each one of those performers for 2 hours before because they had to bring a personal story to that. They had to connect with that character on a visceral way or it wasn't really going to work. And that's why I think ultimately people came out of there saying that was a life-changing experience. And that cast bonded so incredibly well because of not only their talent but their life process that they had gone to get to that place, that it was like – and not in a pejorative sense, it's like being in the high school play where, you know, you were all for one and one for all and you just couldn't wait to get on the stage to do it. So casting has a whole lot to do with it other than just the voice. The voice is a starting place.
And it sounds like you are also throughout your career, not just in the works that you choose and in trying to find new talent, you're willing to take some risks.
Yes. One of the biggest ones I did was when we did Before Night Falls. And in the workshop, we did at Siegel Music Colony, a 22-year-old college junior at that point sang the role of Reinaldo Arenas. And we had been thinking, you know, big singers like Nathan Gunn and, you know, big stars.
Excuse me for interrupting. Is it more of a risk with a young man than it would be with a young woman?
It's a risk either way, mm-hmm. if they're untried.
Uh-huh.
And this character is on stage 95% of the show. I mean, it's a huge mountain for a kid to climb. But after the workshop, both the director and the composer said, you know, this is crazy, but I can't imagine anybody embodying that part. So we hired him, and he was all of 24 when he sang it because it was 2 years down the pike. But on the recording, I still listen to that and think, oh my gosh, that was absolutely the perfect thing. Andrea Carroll last year sang Susanna in Figaro to great notices. I hired her when she was 20 years old, and she missed her college graduation to sing Susanna for us here. Our mission has always been to find the new up-and-coming singer that's going to be a superstar, mainly because our budget is smaller than other companies, and to get really theatrical singers. And we've watched some of them go on to become big superstars. We can't afford them anymore, but we've watched them become big stars.
My guest this hour has been Darren K. Woods. He is general director of the Fort Worth Opera, which has just announced the lineup for its festival seasons of 2014 through 2016. You can find details and find information about the 2013 festival kicking off this spring at fwopera.org. Darren, always a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can download that podcast for free at kera.org/think and find more information about the show. We always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.